Chapter 33. But some time after this renewal of Daniel's agitation, it appeared that Sir Hugo must have been making a merely playful experiment in his question about the singing. He sent for Daniel into the library, and looking up from his writing as the boy entered, threw himself sideways in his armchair. "Ah, Dan," he said kindly, drawing one of the old embroidered stools close to him. "See, come and sit down here." Daniel obeyed, and Sir Hugo put a gentle hand on his shoulder, looking at him affectionately. "What is it, my boy? Have you heard anything that has put you out of spirits lately?" Daniel was determined not to let the tears come, but he could not speak. "All changes are painful when people have been happy, you know," said Sir Hugo, lifting his hand from the boy's shoulder to his dark curls and rubbing them gently. "Why, you can't be educated exactly as I wish you to be without our parting. And I think you will find a great deal to like at school." This was not what Daniel expected, and was so far a relief, which gave him spirit to answer, "Am I to go to school?" "Yes, I mean you to go to Eton. I wish you to have the education of an English gentleman, and for that it is necessary that you should go to a public school in preparation for the university. Cambridge I mean you to go to, it was my own university." Daniel's color came went. "What do you say, sir?" said Sir Hugo, smiling. "I should like to be a gentleman," said Daniel, with firm distinctness, "and go to school, if that is what a gentleman's son must do." Sir Hugo watched him silently for a few moments, thinking he understood now why the lad had seemed angry at the notion of becoming a singer. Then he said tenderly, "And so you won't mind about leaving your old nunc?" "Yes, I shall," said Daniel, clasping Sir Hugo's caressing arm with both his hands. "Be but shan't I come home and be with you in the holidays?" "Oh yes, generally," said Sir Hugo. "Be but now I mean you to go at once to a new tutor, to break the change for you before you go to Eton." After this interview Daniel's spirit rose again. He was meant to be a gentleman, and in some unaccountable way it might be that his conjectures were all wrong. The very keenness of the lad taught him to find comfort in his ignorance. While he was busying his mind in the construction of possibilities, it became plain to him that there must be possibilities of which he knew nothing. He left off brooding, young joy and the spirit of adventure not being easily quenched within him, and in the interval before his going away he sang about the house, danced among the old servants, making them parting gifts, and insisted many times to the groom on the care that was to be taken of the black pony. "Do you think I shall know much less than the other boys, Mr. Fraser?" said Daniel. It was his bent to think that every stranger would be surprised at his ignorance. "There are dunces to be found everywhere," said the judicious Fraser. "You'll not be the biggest, but you've not the makings of a Porson in you, or a Leibniz either." "I don't want to be a Porson or a Leibniz," said Daniel. I would rather be a greater leader, like Pericles or Washington." Eh, you've a notion they did with little parsing and less algebra," said Fraser. But in reality he thought his pupil a remarkable lad, to whom one thing was as easy as another, if he had only a mind to it. Things went on very well with Daniel in his new world, except that a boy with whom he was at once inclined to strike up a close friendship talked to him a great deal about his home and parents, and seemed to expect a like expansiveness in return. Daniel immediately shrank into reserve, and this experience remained a check on his naturally strong bent toward the formation of intimate friendship. Everyone, his tutor included, set him down as a reserved boy, though he was so good-humored and unassuming, as well as quick, both at study and sport, that nobody called his reserve disagreeable. Certainly his face had a great deal to do with that favorable interpretation, but in this instance the beauty of the closed lips told no falsehood. A surprise that came to him before his first vacation strengthened the silent consciousness of a grief within, which might be compared in some ways with Byron's susceptibility about his deformed foot. Sir Hugo wrote word that he was married to Miss Raymond, a sweet lady, whom Daniel must remember having seen. The event would make no difference about his spending the vacation at the Abbey. He would find Lady Malinger a new friend whom he would be sure to love, and much more to the usual effect when a man, having done something agreeable to himself, is disposed to congratulate others on his own good fortune, and the deducible satisfactoriness of events in general. Let Sir Hugo be partly excused until the grounds of his action can be more fully known. The mistakes in his behavior to Deronda were due to that dullness toward what may be going on in other minds, especially the minds of children, which is among the commonest deficiencies, even in good-natured men like him, when life has been generally easy to themselves, and their energies have been quietly spent in feeling gratified. No one was better aware than he that Daniel was generally suspected to be his own son. But he was pleased with that suspicion, and his imagination had never once been troubled with the way in which the boy himself might be affected, either then or in the future, by the enigmatic aspect of his circumstances. He was as fond of him as could be, and meant the best by him. And, considering the lightness with which the preparation of young lives seemed to lie on respectable consciences, Sir Hugo Malinger can hardly be held open to exceptional reproach. He had been a bachelor till he was 45, had always been regarded as a fascinating man of elegant tastes. What could be more natural, even according to the index of language, than that he should have a beautiful boy like a little Deronda to take care of? The mother might even, perhaps, be in the great world met with in Sir Hugo's residence abroad. The only person to feel any objection was the boy himself, who could not have been consulted. And the boy's objections had never been dreamed of by anybody but himself. By the time Deronda was ready to go to Cambridge, Lady Malinger had already three daughters, charming babies, all three, but whose sex was announced as a melancholy alternative, the offspring desired being a son. If Sir Hugo had no son, the succession must go to his nephew, Malinger Grandcourt. Daniel no longer held a wavering opinion about his own birth. His fuller knowledge had tended to convince him that Sir Hugo was his father, and he conceived that the baronet, since he never approached a communication on the subject, wished him to have a tacit understanding of the fact, and to accept in silence what would be generally considered more than the due love and nurture. Sir Hugo's marriage might certainly have been felt as a new ground of resentment by some youths in Deronda's position, and the timid Lady Malinger with her fast-coming little ones might have been images to scowl at, as likely to divert much that was disposable in the feelings and possessions of the baronet from one who felt his own claim to be prior. But hatred of innocent human obstacles was a form of moral stupidity not in Deronda's grain. Even the indignation which had long mingled itself with his affection for Sir Hugo took the quality of pain, rather than of temper, and as his mind ripened to the idea of tolerance toward error, he habitually liked the idea with his own silent grievances. The sense of an entailed disadvantage, the deformed foot doubtfully hidden by the shoe, makes a restlessly active spiritual east, and easily turns a self-centered, unloving nature into an Ishmaelite. But in the rarer sort, who presently see their own frustrated claim as one among a myriad, the inexorable sorrow takes the form of fellowship and makes the imagination tender. Deronda's early weakened susceptibility, charged at first with ready indignation and resistant pride, had raised in him a premature reflection on certain questions of life. It had given a bias to his conscience, a sympathy with certain ills, and a tension of resolve in certain directions, who marked him off from other youths much more than any talents he possessed. One day near the end of the long vacation, when he had been making a tour in the Rhineland with his Eton tutor, and was come for a farewell stay at the Abbey, before going to Cambridge, he He said to Sir Hugo, "What do you intend me to be, sir?" They were in the library, and it was a fresh morning. Sir Hugo had called him in to read a letter from a Cambridge don who was to be interested in him. And since the baronet wore an air at once businesslike and leisurely, the moment seemed propitious for entering on a grave subject which had never yet been thoroughly discussed. "Whatever your inclination leads you to, my boy, I thought it right to give you the option of the army, but you shut the door on that, and I was glad. I don't expect you to choose just yet. By and by, when you have looked about you a little more, and tried your mettle among older men. The university has a good wide opening into the forum. There are prizes to be won, and a bit of good fortune often gives the turn to a man's taste. From what I see and hear, I should think you can take up anything you like. You are in the deeper water with your classics than I ever got into, and if you are rather sick of that swimming, Cambridge is the place, where you can go into mathematics with a will, and disport yourself on the dry sand as much as you like. I floundered along like a carp. I suppose money will make some difference, sir," said Daniel, blushing. I shall have to keep myself by and by." "Not exactly. I recommend you not to be extravagant." "Yes, yes, I know you are not inclined to that. But you need not take up anything against the grain. You will have a bachelor's income enough for you to look about with. Perhaps I had better tell you that you may consider yourself secure of 700 a year. You might make yourself a barrister, be a writer, take up politics. I confess that is what would please me best. I should like to have you at my elbow and pulling with me." Deronda looked embarrassed. He felt that he ought to make some sign of gratitude, but other feelings clogged his tongue. A moment was passing by in which a question about his birth was throbbing within him, and yet it seemed more impossible than ever that the question should find vent, more impossible than ever that he could hear certain things from Sir Hugo's lips. The liberal way in which he was dealt with was the more striking, because the baronet had of late cared particularly for money, and for making the utmost of his life interest in the estate by way of providing for his daughters. And as all this flashed through Daniel's mind, it was momentarily within his imagination that the provision for him might come in some way from his mother. But such vaporous conjecture passed away as quickly as it came. Sir Hugo appeared not to notice anything peculiar in Daniel's manner, and presently went on with his usual chatty liveliness. "I am glad you have done some good reading outside your classics, and have got a grip of French and German. The truth is, unless a man can get the prestige and income of a don, and write donnish books, it's hardly worth while for him to make a Greek and Latin machine of himself, and be able to spin you out pages of the Greek dramatists that any verse you will give him as a cue. That's all very fine, but in practical life nobody does give you the cue for pages of Greek. In fact, it's a nicety of conversation which I would have you attend to. Much quotation of any sort, even in English, is bad. It tends to choke ordinary remark. One couldn't carry on life comfortably without a little blindness to the fact that everything had been said better than we can put it ourselves. But talking of dons, I have seen dons make a capital figure in society, and occasionally he can shoot you down a cartload of learning in the right place, which will tell in politics. Such men are wanted, and if you have any turn for being a don, I say nothing against it. I think there's not much chance of that. Quickset and Puller are both stronger than I am. I hope you will not be much disappointed if I don't come out with high honors." "No, no. I should like you to do yourself credit, but for God's sake don't come out as a superior expensive kind of idiot, like young Brecon, who got a double first, and has been learning to knit braces ever since. What I wish you to get is a passport in life. I don't go against our university system. We want a little disinterested culture to make head against cotton and capital, especially in the house. My Greek has all evaporated. If I had to construe a verse on a sudden, I should get an apoplectic fit. But it formed my taste. I dare say my English is the better for it. On this point, Daniel kept a respectful silence. The enthusiastic belief in Sir Hugo's writings as a standard, and in the Whigs as the chosen race among politicians, had gradually vanished along with the seraphic boy's face. He had not been the hardest of workers at Eton, though some kinds of study and reading came as easily as boating to him. He was not of the material that usually makes the first-rate Eton scholar. There had sprung up in him a meditative yearning after wide knowledge which is likely always to abate ardor in the fight for prize acquirement in narrow tracks. Happily he was modest, and took any second-rateness in himself simply as a fact, not as a marvel necessarily, to be accounted for by a superiority. Still Mr. Eraser's high opinion of the lad had not been altogether belied by the youth. Daniel had the stamp of rarity in a subdued fervor of sympathy, an activity of imagination on behalf of others which did not show itself effusively, but was continually seen in acts of considerateness that struck his companions as moral eccentricity. Deuteronda would have been first rate if he had had more ambition, was a frequent remark about him. But how could a fellow push his way properly when he objected to swap for his own advantage, knocked under by choice, when he was within an inch of victory, and, unlike the great Clive, would rather be the calf than the butcher? It was a mistake, however, to suppose that Deronda had not his share of ambition. We know he had suffered keenly from the belief that there was a tinge of dishonor in his lot. But there are some cases, and his was one of them, in which the sense of injury breeds not the will to inflict injuries and climb over them as a ladder, but a hatred of all injury. He had his flashes of fierceness, and could hit out upon occasion, but the occasions were not always what might have been expected. For in what related to himself, his resentful impulses had been early checked by a mastering affectionateness. Love has a habit of saying never mind to angry self, who, sitting down for the nonce in the lower place, by and by gets used to it. So it was that as Deronda approached manhood, his feeling for Sir Hugo, while it was getting more and more mixed with criticism, was gaining in that sort of allowance which reconciles criticism with tenderness. The dear old beautiful home, and everything within it, Lady Malinger and her little ones included, were consecrated for the youth as they had been for the boy, only with a certain difference of light on the objects. The altarpiece was no longer miraculously perfect, painted under infallible guidance, but the human hand discerned in the work was appealing to a reverent tenderness safer from the gusts of discovery. Certainly Deronda's ambition, even in his springtime, lay exceptionally aloof from conspicuous, vulgar triumph, and from other ugly forms of boyish energy, perhaps because he was early impassioned by ideas, and burned his fire on those heights. One may spend a good deal of energy in disliking and resisting what others pursue, and a boy who is fond of somebody else's pencil case may not be more energetic than another who is fond of giving his own pencil case away. Still, it was not Deronda's disposition to escape from ugly scenes. He was more inclined to sit through them and take care of the fellow least able to take care of himself. It had helped to make him popular that he was sometimes a little compromised by this apparent comradeship. For a meditative interest in learning how human miseries are wrought as precocious in him as another sort of genius in the poet who writes a Queen Mab at 19 was so infused with kindliness that it easily passed for comradeship. Enough. In many of our neighbors' lives there is much, not only of error and lapse, but of a certain exquisite goodness which can never be written, or even spoken, only divined by each of us, according to the inward instruction of our own privacy. The impression he made at Cambridge corresponded to his position at Eton. Everyone interested in him agreed that he might have taken a high place if his motives had been of a more pushing sort, and if he had not, instead of regarding studies as instruments of success, hampered himself with the notion that they were to feed motive and opinion, a notion which set him criticizing methods and arguing against his freight and harness when he should have been using all his might to pull. In the beginning, his work at the university had a new zest for him. Indifferent to the continuation of Eton classical drill, he applied himself vigorously to mathematics, for which he had shown an early aptitude under Mr. Fraser, and he had the delight of feeling his strength in a comparatively fresh exercise of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.